Hello, and welcome to another episode of Multifamily Real Estate Investing presented by Mara Poling. A warm welcome back to all of our regular listeners, and a special thank you to those of you that are joining us for the first time this week. My name is Pat Poling. I am the founder and CEO of Mara Poling. Every week, we're happy to present another topic about multifamily real estate investing. This week, it's a special topic in that it's too big for one episode. So, this is part one of optimizing cash income. And I invite you to join us again next week for part two, when we'll finish up our discussion about optimizing cash income. Before we get started on our content today about multifamily real estate investing, it is the Saturday before Memorial Day. This is coming out on Tuesday, the day after Memorial Day is celebrated here. And we'd like to take a moment just to honor those that have contributed to this great country that we live in, that their courage and dedication will never be forgotten. We'd like to honor those who gave their lives for our country. Our warmest wishes on Memorial Day, and our deepest gratitude for the ultimate sacrifice of our fallen heroes. Thank you all, and with that, let's dive into optimizing cash income. A lot of you that listen are in the process of or already have built real estate portfolios of your own, some single-family homes, duplexes, fourplexes, and some of you have larger portfolios, 50 units, 100 units, or more. It's a pretty wonderful range that our listeners participate in. And most of our listeners are folks that are either invested in or looking to invest in real estate investments with firms like Mara Poling. And know that a number of you actually are our clients. So again, thank you to those of you that are. Today's content is going to be of value to the entire audience. So those of you that have your own portfolios or are working on building portfolios of your own, I have great confidence that you'll find value in what we're going to talk about regarding optimizing cash income. And for those of you that are looking to make investments or already have investments in real estate syndications, such as the Mara Poling Total Return Fund, optimizing cash income should be part of that equation. And I would encourage you to have that conversation with your sponsor, asset manager, whatever the term is you want to use for them. And if you are interested in working with us, please feel free to reach out. I'll give it to you a couple times throughout the session today, but if you have any questions or would like to learn more about Mara Poling or learn more just about this topic in particular, feel free to shoot me an email, pat@marapoling.com, MaraPoling.com. All right, so let's get going. Well, we want to spend some time today talking about levers. And what I mean by levers is this: when we build an underwrite and are looking at acquiring an asset, there are a very large number of inputs that go into the underwrite. I've actually not counted them. I should go back and do that and share that with you. So there's a very large number, and they range from all the different individual expense items to the growth rates of baseline rents and the capital investments for value add improvements and a whole host of other things. They are not all created equal. Some of those inputs have more leverage, meaning a 1% movement in one lever, in one variable, in one input, may generate a 5% movement in net operating income relative to another item that, if you moved at 1%, would only contribute to, a minor, maybe even a 1% movement in net operating income when you aggregate that into the whole. So we want to talk about those levers that have the greatest impact. And so we're going to spend a few minutes going over and addressing those. Obviously, these levers would be the items then that if you're looking to optimize cash income, you would be looking to optimize these particular inputs. So we're gonna walk through those and see what we can do in terms of making some improvements to cash income. So if you grab your net operating income statement, your income statement, your profit and loss, whatever the term is you use for that. And again, for those of you that work with us or that work with a firm like us, you should already have or should ask for a copy of that material for the assets that you're invested in. And then you can follow along as well in terms of, okay, let me see how all this actually works. So it's pretty straightforward, right? So the nice people that live in our properties pay us rent. And then we turn around and pay the operating expenses. So things like property taxes and insurance and the gardener and, you know, the water bill and a whole bunch of other things. And when we're done doing that, that leaves us with that number called net operating income. There's still a few things we need to pay on the cash side. The most significant being we have to pay the mortgage because we do have debt on these properties. When you've done all of that, you've got cash left over, and that's the cash that becomes distributable to investors. So that's true in an investment like the Mara Poling Total Return Fund. That's also true if you own a duplex. Now, you may not look at it that way. I know there are folks out there that quote unquote own their duplex free and clear, and they did so by taking a loan out against their primary residence. And that may or may not be calculated in their calculation of cash. You can calculate cash however you like. If you've borrowed money to purchase something, that should be part of the equation there. So it ought to track for all of you in the audience, whichever situation you might happen to be in. So we want to look at the inputs to net operating income. The reason we aren't looking at the input to the mortgage payment is this, is the mortgage payment is about leverage on the property, leverage, debt leverage. If you increase the leverage on an asset, so you go from having a 70% loan to having an 80% loan, you will increase the return in most instances, unless you're in an extremely high interest rate environment. So you're going to increase your return. You're also increasing the risk profile. And that's a different conversation. And we have had that before, and we'll certainly have that again here not too far down the road about increasing the security and stability of your investment by using debt intelligently. So we're not going to talk about that today because, yes, that's a big lever. It has more to do with risk profile than optimizing the performance of an asset. So we're going to set that aside. So if we're doing that, that means that we're really focusing on how to optimize net operating income, because that's what will drive cash income. So let's look at the items that are significant when it comes to net operating income. So if you grabbed one of our financial statements for any one of our assets, and begin scanning down the page, especially on the operating expense side. Let's start there. One of the items that would leap out at you would be utilities. And you would go, wow, that's really a big opportunity. At many properties, and this is typical in the larger asset space that we operate in, 100, 200, 300, 400 unit properties, maybe not so likely with fourplexes or duplexes, although it's possible that it's set up that way. And single families are going to be a very different kind of model. In these larger assets, it's very common that some of those utilities are actually billed to the property on a master meter, and then they are allocated through something called a ratio utility billing system, RUBS is the term you may hear, back to the tenants. For some properties that can involve all the utilities, water, sewer, gas, electric. Many, if not most properties, it's water and sewer. So it's those two components. So when you look at the utility bill and look at the expenses, you'll see, oh my gosh, look at this huge line item here. That must be an opportunity for us to make improvements. And it is. There certainly can be improvements on the utility side. They're modest. And the reason I say they're modest is this is, and we're encouraged not just economically because we can get better debt if we implement green programs. We're also encouraged because it's a good thing to do, and we are, we believe, good citizens of the communities that we live in. But ultimately, those are not going to take us from, say, $100,000 a month in utility expenditures to $50,000 or whatever the number might happen to be for the various properties. It's just not going to move the needle 50%. You can nibble around the edges, but ultimately, you're not going to move it a great deal. And then here's the other side of it. Because you're billing that back, if there were to be a significant reduction in utilities, there'd be a similar reduction in the income that came in to offset it. So that doesn't mean we don't want to try and, again, be good stewards of the environment and optimize utility usage. It simply means that's not going to be a big NOI driver. So set that one aside. Utilities aren't the place that you're really going to get bang for your buck in terms of trying to optimize cash income. Taxes, property taxes. There are property taxes associated with the real estate, and then there's usually a relatively modest line item for personal property taxes. So this would have to do, in our instances, with things like the computers and other kind of stuff we have maybe in the office. It's a very small line item, so we can kind of ignore that. And then there may be some local tax that you're subject to, depending upon the jurisdiction that you're in. That might be tied to the revenue that's generated or the like. What I'm talking about right now is going to be the property taxes. Property taxes are a big deal. Depending upon where you are in the country, you may be in a market where property taxes are modest. But even then, you're talking about something in the neighborhood of maybe 1.25% of the assessed value. Or they may be larger. That might be 2, 2.5, even 3%. You might be in markets where the typical assessment is 70 or 80% of what the anticipated value actually is. You might be in markets where it's actually 100%. And you might be in markets where it resets and can be reassessed annually. Or in markets where there's actually restrictions on how often that can occur. Whatever one of those situations you happen to be in, and our properties are generally in markets where they can be reassessed more often, and the rates are in that 2.5 to 3% range, and we're assessed some percentage of what we believe probably the ultimate value actually is. What do I do about that? How do I change taxes? Well, you can appeal your property tax assessment. And, you know, if you've been assessed an appropriate value for what your property is worth, an appeal may be not worthwhile. One, you may or may not prevail. If you do, the change in the tax that you pay could be modest. And it's not free to do that. Not only does it cost a few dollars to file and do those sorts of things, but you have to have somebody do that work for you. And there are consultants out there that will take that on. When you are looking down your list of expenses and what's a big number, property taxes is going to jump off the page at you. So having a strategy for how to manage property taxes, not only in terms of going in, but how you budget for those in the future and what you might do if, in fact, you get an assessment that's erroneous. We've certainly experienced that where we've had properties that were assessed substantially higher than what we purchased them for, which, you know, we just kind of scratched our head. And so we did go through the process and get those changed, which worked out well for us. You know, beyond that, there's not a way, if you will, in our mind, to quote unquote make money on taxes, right? You're not going to be able to get some significant advantage that you wouldn't get otherwise. This is more of an area where making sure that you're getting an appropriate amount, but it's a big number, so it can have a real impact. So you want to watch that lever. Next is the cost of operating the property from a personnel standpoint. So your management expenses, your on-site staff, benefit costs, insurance for the personnel, those sorts of things. And that can vary widely. In our situation, we use a hybrid property management model. So we have a third-party property management firm that we utilize. That's how we hire the on-site staff, and we access some back office activities like some frontline accounting and some other activities. And then we have our own operations staff that's layered on top of that. And together, those are the activities we use to manage these properties. Management becomes more challenging the smaller your property gets. And as it gets smaller and smaller, it can be not only more expensive to find management, but it can also be more difficult to find effective management. And that's not because there aren't really good people that do a good job and are very dedicated when you get into the smaller space, the duplex, the fourplex. It's simply that it's really a challenge to manage 25 fourplexes as opposed to managing one 100 unit property. But that's a big line item. And it's not only a big line item that that you have an opportunity to make savings on to optimize your cash return. It's one that can actually spin in the opposite direction and work against you from that standpoint. So, so taxes would be an item to keep an eye on. Next would be your cost of management, your staff, and so on. Another component that we would then move to would be the other income items. Now, for those of you that have smaller assets, you may have a relatively modest amount of other income relative to your total NOI and total rent flow. That may be an area you could look to improve upon. In a property like ours, it's very common in the markets that we invest in for there to be, for example, pet rent. People love having pets, and there is some additional expense associated with that and some additional value in the proposition. So tenants will generally pay some pet rent in order to have a pet. So that's another income line. Some properties will have the availability of assigned parking or some covered parking. Those are items that people would pay some additional income for. If the units have washer dryer hookups in them, then renting washer dryers would be a additional other income item. If that's not the case, and there are laundry facilities on the property, then there's laundry income. There can be vending income. In our experience, that's not typically a large item. And then there's all the fee income, right? So people pay application fees when they come in. There are recovered deposits that occur from time to time and the like. There are tenants that will get to the end of a lease and need to stay for an extra 30 days because the property they're moving to or their home they're purchasing or whatever isn't quite ready yet. And so there are month-to-month fees that people will pay. And so that's an area that can be very fruitful is to go through and, one, look at all the items that are in place today. Are you, in fact, billing all of those and collecting all of those correctly? And then, two, what are the opportunities to optimize those? Are you spending $5 a unit per month on pest services and only billing $3. And when you look at what the competition's doing, they're billing 10. There's obviously an opportunity there to, at a minimum, recover the cost that you're out, if not potentially have a modest amount of margin associated with that. So other income can be a very fruitful area to explore. The next that I would encourage you to look at, right, as we're working up our list of levers, is another one of the revenue items, and that's what I would describe as the net rental income. So this is rent that's paid by tenants netted out for total vacancy. So total vacancy would be actual vacant units, the concessions that are being provided to tenants, could be to new tenants, could be ongoing concessions, and the bad debt, right? So tenants that owed rent and ultimately never paid the rent. Maybe they moved out, maybe they were evicted, whatever the reason, there was a balance on their account when they left and that had to be written off. That is, for our purposes today, what I would describe as net rent. Net rent, in our minds, is the second biggest lever you have in driving NOI, in optimizing that, which ultimately, as we said, optimizes the cash income. So how do you do that? And why is it the biggest lever? So the occupancy piece, the vacancy side of it, physical vacancy is a art, not a science. Now, there are, for larger systems out there, and we have experience with this, for larger systems out there, there are tools you can use, tools, databases that will allow us to very precisely dial in what the rent in the market should be at any given particular point in time relative to optimizing the amount of occupancy. Those tools become effective and cost effective when you get into larger properties. When you're at a smaller property, and certainly when you're at a 40-plex or a smaller, a duplex or a fourplex, you're not going to have tools like that. And this, again, would be something to explore when you're making an investment with the sponsor that you're working with. How do you all manage rent and occupancy? How do you manage the trade-off on those two? For us, we try to look for a fairly balanced approach. We do, in fact, want to see a certain amount of physical vacancy for several reasons. One, we're a value-add strategy provider, meaning that when we purchase a property, there are improvements we'd like to make to those individual units. We need the unit vacant to be able to do that. And so if our renewal rates were 100%, we would never get around to making any of the improvements. So we need a certain amount of vacancy to be able to support that. Even when you've done those kinds of improvements, or if you're managing a property where you don't have something going on those ways, if the market rents are moving significantly, in other words, meaning that the market you're in is growing rapidly in terms of rents, maybe the rents are moving 5% or 7% or something along those lines, or when you purchased it, there was a pretty good delta already between the rents on your property and the rents in the marketplace. Well, it can be not just challenging, but unrealistic to go to an existing tenant and at renewal say, I'm sorry, but your rent needs to go up 20% because that's what the market is. Now, that may in fact be what the market is. And if that tenant moved out, you might be able to turn around and rent that unit for that new amount. It's going to be generally very difficult for an existing tenant to make a 20% rent movement all at once. Now, there might be some strategies where you could do that over some period of time, but even then, it's going to be challenging. So there will be some vacancies that occur as you move rents towards what the market's charging, right? So I'm not talking about, nor are we suggesting that you should be charging or that we would be charging a significant premium to the market. We're simply talking about getting in line with the market. And if the property's not been managed that way in the past, there could be some deltas that need to be addressed. So when you're doing that, you're going to drive a certain amount of physical vacancy. That's healthy. When we look at assets for purchase and we get the proud on-site property manager standing there with their shoulders broad and a big grin on their face because they are 100% occupied and they get 90% renewals. To me, that sounds like, okay, there's money on the table because we're not managing rents as well as they could be managed. Because if rents are moving at the market, you are going to have some turnover. And by the way, just as an aside, there is no such thing as 100% occupancy. It just flat out can't happen. The math doesn't work that way. Somewhere in the 97% range is 100%, because when you do have people move out, we experience this all the time. Somebody will give notice. They're going to move out at the end of the month. We may, the day they give notice, lease that unit. And it's rare that someone will move in even within maybe a week of when that unit becomes available. One, there's some cleaning and a few other things that need to be done to turn that unit and get it ready. But even if you discount those days, generally units will sit empty for a week or maybe a couple of weeks in between tenancies, even though they're quote unquote leased. Well, that's vacancy, even though you can look at that and say, well, there's not really any way I can sell that space. I can't lease 2 weeks of a unit in between two tenants. Well, that's correct, which is why 97% or so, when you've got a certain amount of rent movement and occupancy movement, is fully occupied. So that's a piece of it. The other two components of vacancy to work on are, really straightforward, right? Concessions. So you're basically, especially if the concessions are large, which would mean greater than 1% of what the total rent is that you're looking at, you're paying people to live in your property. And really high concessions over a long period of time, you may simply have the wrong rent structure in place. We don't have a lot of experience with concessions. We don't do a lot of concessions at our assets. Again, if you're managing the property and staying on top of what the competitive marketplace is, the concession number should be, again, within that 1% range or a little smaller. Bad debt is a killer. It's an item that if you're looking to optimize cash income, bad debt should absolutely be one of the items that is tops on your list, because every dollar that you have to write off is a dollar of cash flow that just disappeared. There's absolutely nothing else that happens to that. And by the way, not only do you lose that dollar, but you lose the money associated with having to go chase that dollar, which goes back to the management and salary and wages component we talked about a few moments ago. So those are really key pieces. So that's the vacancy side of it. Obviously, if we're talking about the net rent, that also includes the rent growth. And rent growth is the second biggest lever you're going to have in terms of how you can optimize cash income. And I want to spend an appropriate amount of time talking about that and talking about the number one item. And unfortunately, that's why we're going to have to break this into two sessions. Otherwise, we'd end up with a very long, unwieldy podcast. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to wrap up for today. As I said, if you've got questions about today's content, or in general about multifamily real estate investing, shoot me an email, pat@marapoling.com, MaraPoling.com. You can also swing by the website. We've got some great material there that I hope you will find of value. Please join us again next week, because we're going to do part two of optimizing cash income, when we're going to get into the specifics of rent movement, and that lever and what the opportunities are there, and some thoughts about how to optimize that number. And we're going to talk about the number one driver, the number one lever that you have in terms of optimizing cash income, and a few other thoughts about some strategies that can be used over a slightly longer period of time, so not on an annual basis, but over a longer period of time, that can substantially drive your cash income. And so we're going to talk about all of that next week. I invite you to join us again then for the next episode of Multifamily Real Estate Investing, presented by Mara Poling. Thanks.